this meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Members present, Representative Wool, Representative Klaman, Representative Tilton, Co-Chair Vasquez, and myself, Co-Chair Culver. Today, we have an overview on rural energy partnerships by Joe Bovey, Vice President of OTNA. Then we will have a presentation on House Bill 78, Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And we will then finish up the day with taking up HB 105, ADA Bonds Programs and Loans, an LNG project, and is intended of the chair to move that bill out of committee today. So with that, do we have, is there any questions or any comments on the agenda by the committee? Hearing none, we'll move into this presentation. Joe, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, you have the floor. We have your PowerPoint up. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the Energy Committee. For ease of going through our PowerPoint, first of all, my name is Joe Bovey. I'm the Vice President of Land Resources at OTNA Incorporated. Our presentation today is Rural Energy Partnerships within the Copper River Valley region. And with me today is Bruce Kane from OTNA. He's a Special Projects Coordinator. Travis Million, Manager of Power Generation at Copper Valley Electric Association. And then also Jason Hulk, Executive Director of Copper Valley Development Association. So if you go to the second slide, overview of presentation, we'll just kind of give you a brief synopsis of what we'd like to discuss today. And we're going to start off with Jason Hulk with the Copper Basin Regional Energy Plan. I'll take the second portion of OTNA gas exploration in the region. The third will be with the Copper Valley Electric Association, Travis Million, about the intertie between Glen Allen and Sutton, and then follow up with the Glen Allen LNG demonstration project. So the third slide, and I'll hand it over to Jason Hulk.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Energy Committee. My name is Jason Hulk. I'm the Executive Director for Copper Valley Development Association. We are the regional arbiter for this area. Here's a map that kind of gives you an idea of our region, extending all the way up beyond Paxson, over to the Mat-Su Burrow, south to Valdez, the municipality of Valdez, and west almost to the Canadian border. Just some stats about the Copper Valley. We are an unorganized borough with no municipalities. That sets us aside from many other places which may have a municipality within it. 20,649 square miles. We're about the size of Ohio. We have 23 communities, 8 tribal governments, including Cantwell, which is out on the far end of the Denali Highway and in the Denali Borough, and 2 native corporations, OTNA and the Chitna Corp. We have approximately 3,000 residents, and we are declining rapidly. We are on the road belt with a rural lifestyle and the high expenses of rural living.
Next slide.
CVDA has been contracted as the regional arbiter with Alaska Energy Authority for the regional energy plan. We completed the draft phase one. We are just about in the completion stage of phase two, having a regional energy summit on March 7th. This has increased the collaboration from all of the 23 communities in the area, the tribes, the regional businesses, energy companies, including AP&T to the north, and CVEA. This is one thing that has really brought us all together. What you'll hear a little bit later is how we're hoping one of our identified long-term goals would be intertie with the rail belt along the road belt. And I'll let Mr. Million talk more about that. Natural gas is fairly abundant out here, and I'll let Mr. Bovey go ahead and talk a little bit more about the natural gas exploration that's underway. The LNG feasibility project, which is linked with the Interior Energy Plan, is also something we're identifying as how to utilize some of the resources within the state. I've had the opportunity to present this to Mr. Culver and Representative Tallarico, and I'll let Bruce Kane elaborate on that later. Summer Hydro with the storage and cogeneration is already being developed out at Allison Creek, but again, that's not fully enough to wean us off of the very expensive fossil fuels. All of this kind of fits into the Alaska LNG overall project. We are blessed in this area with a multitude of resources: hydro, biomass, solar, some wind, some geothermal. And we hope to drill down the feasibilities on all of these resources. Just also to mention, one of the opportunities is the non-state dollars that have come into this region. For instance, Ardor has leveraged $4 for every $1 we receive from the state, most of which we put towards energy and energy development. Privately, ATA has invested $3 million in the last year alone and is trying to leverage that for federal dollars. And Copper Valley Electric Association has invested $8 million in the Allison Creek project on its own. Also, small businesses have, CBDA has helped them attain USDA Rural Energy for America programs, totaling up over $1 million to help energy efficiency and reduce energy costs for small businesses in this area. And on that note, I thank you very much for your time, and I will turn this over to Mr. Bobie.
Members of the Energy Committee. The first slide that I'm going to go through is the header. It's entitled Copper River Basin Natural Gas Invitation to the Hub Energy Committee. And just to kind of give you more of a little bit of background, because energy is a tie that binds, especially in rural Alaska. We all come from different backgrounds and cultural identities. Energy and the high cost of it kind of unites us all on one front. The next slide is titled Oil and Gas Basins in Alaska. And these regions with the circles around them are identified in the Middle Earth Tax Credit. And for our reference here, Glen Allen, the Copper River Basin, is the orange circle to the center right of the photograph of the map. Next slide. Over the last 10 or 15 years, we've done a lot of research out here. We've drilled a couple wells from the late 90s to early 2000s, and prior to that, we drilled about six, there was about six or seven other wells drilled out here in the early 60s through the late 80s. Geological structure of interest currently under state land. We did receive a State of Alaska exploration license for the, what's known as the Tolsona Block, and encompasses about 44,000 acres. To date, for the last 30 or 40 years, millions of dollars have been invested in the exploration in our region to date. And as Mr. Hulk mentioned before, in the last year, 14 months, ATNA has invested about $3 million in the Tolsona project west of Glen Allen. Previous geological data and past exploration give strong natural gas indications. Of all the seven or eight wells that was drilled out here in the previous 40 years, all of them had gas shows. The other positive point of the region out here is that the formation is accessible to South Central Alaska, the population centers, and it's also accessible to the state highway road systems and Tidewater and Valdez. Some technical drilling challenges were identified due to high water pressure zones. In the meantime, we have conducted some discussions and contracts with engineers, and we can alleviate the high pressure zones now that we know where it's at and the depths associated with it. Next slide. This slide is the Copper River Basin Natural Gas, and it goes back to the Middle Earth Frontier Tax Credit Zone. On the map, you'll see a red line outlining the natural gas basin that's been explored in the previous 40 or 50 years. There's certain indications of natural gas and even possibility of some shale oil in this within the red outline of the circle there. And for more detail, if you look in the center of the map, there's a white line, it's actually a rectangle. That's the area of interest that we've been exploring here now the last 12 to 14 months, all of which is on State of Alaska land. The yellow area within and encompassing part of the white rectangular block is more of the prime target zone where we have just conducted about 40 miles of 2D seismic. On this same map, it also shows previous oil and gas exploration wells, and there are white circles. So you can see there's quite a range or extent of previous exploration that has been done by private companies throughout the last 40 or 50 years. Next slide. Geological summary. Through all the inventory and data that we went through and researched and transposed and corrected and modified to current forms and formations and testing that's available today versus from 40 years ago, we've identified porous, permeable, and hydrocarbon-bearing lower Cretaceous zones. Well, what that means is that we have the capability for gas structures here because of the correct geology to hold the gas. It doesn't evaporate or disseminate. Several large fault-bounded geological structures have been identified, and for the most part, through this region here, we have four fault-bounded structures that we have identified, two of which cross over and onto the state land in the Tolsona block. The one bad thing here is the high water pressure zone was identified at about 1,100 feet with pressures exceeding or up to 1,000 pounds per square inch. On the lower portion of the geological summary, there's kind of a cross-section of some of the previous oil and gas wells that have been drilled out here because it shows a little bit of the geology of the region here. One was done by Union Oil, another was done by Mobil Oil, Atlantic Richfield, and so on. So it just kind of gives you an update or an idea of what the subsurface geology looks like in the region. Prior to our exploration, we came and went through a range of market opportunities. Excuse me, next slide, range of market opportunities. This is critical to our exploration and development. We've determined that if we can only produce thousands of BTUs per day, there would probably be no development. It wouldn't be feasible economically to go in there for just a small amount. Millions of BTUs produced daily, it would obviously promote or produce enough for the Copper Basin market, which would hopefully include the Electric Association, the school district, commercial and residential markets along the way. Billions of BTUs produced per day, it would likely mean that we could produce and transport hydrocarbons in-state or to international markets. Next slide. We've also determined from previous fuel costs, usage, that sort of thing, that the local market is viable. And I'll just go back that all of our intent here is not to probably produce hydrocarbons or natural gas to export or in-state or internationally at this time because we have such a high need and dependency on fuel oil out here that our low-hanging fruit is to produce it locally so that we can lower the cost of energy out here and keep more residents local and in-state instead of moving to the valley or outside. This snapshot of the local market is viable. Basically, we did this a month or so ago based on $4 a gallon fuel oil. It has went down, but still it shows it's viable because at $4 or even what is now slightly over $3, we'd be saving somewhere about 40 to 50% on today's market of the fuel oil. So there is considerable savings here and also developing an industry for future growth. Next slide, conclusion and next steps. We've got this in the queue, and we're engineering and designing a new well with well completion prior to early 2016. So far, we've been on time, on schedule, and on budget with our exploration. But the critical thing here is to develop a new well location, which we're in the final stages of identifying our recent seismic exploration. And within probably the next week or two, we will have identified a new well site. And from all of our preliminary investigations and research and data that we've done so far, it's going to turn out better than what we had hoped for. It's very promising because, like I said previously, this whole gas structure that will soon be identified is all on the state of Alaska land. Another step that we're doing now and working through is finalizing RCA application for local gas distribution. This is rather time-consuming working through the RCA regulations and things like that because the permit is required. The application process can take up to a year, and that doesn't include gaining or granting the right-of-ways to get the gas from the Tolsona state-owned lands back into Glen Allen. The other steps that we're also pursuing or evaluating is determining and developing markets. One could be, if there's a large enough find, it would be a pipeline. Another one that has been discussed throughout the state of Alaska is a micro LNG plant, which would include trucking to other rural communities and hubs of Alaska, and also the electrical intertie, which Mr. Million will discuss here next.
Thank you, Joe. As you said, my name is Travis Million. I am the manager of Power Generation in Copper Belly.
Hold on a second. Let me get Joe back on the line. Mr. Bogey.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So, can you, looking at your, you just finished the seismic work, right?
Yes.
Can you comment on the prospects of that basin, the Tulsana area, based on the seismic as far as compared to the other data you had available?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. When we first were granted the license from the state of Alaska, we were required to expend a certain amount of work commitment. In so doing, we reprocessed about 90 miles of old seismic data from the 70s and 80s. With doing that, we identified that there was a lapse or a gap in the data, so we came back to the state and acquired a permit to do some seismic work this last winter in November and December, which we completed just prior to Christmas, which was about 40 miles. And so doing, with the new seismic, we tied the old lines in with the new lines. Prior to doing that, we had identified a gas structure just east of the Tulsana Lake area on state land. It's about mile 172, but we only had one side of the structure. So after we did the seismic and we're about three-quarters of the way through processing the data, we identified the structure and we now have four sides to it. The specific crest of that structure we have yet to identify, but that should be done here in the next week or two. So the size of the structure is yet to be determined, but just for comparison of what we know now and our preliminary data, which will be finalized here in the next week or two, it's about 5 miles square at the base of it at about 5,000 feet.
Thank you. Can you explain for the committee some of the challenges of that basin? Is it pressure related, some of the other wells that I've encountered, and how this target basin may be more productive than the previous attempts?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Two or three previous wells that were done out here, drilled out here in the 90s and early 2000s, they encountered high pressure water zones and also high pressure gas zones, which we were not privy to at the time. So we had much too small of equipment. The challenges associated with that, talking to some oil and gas engineers, drilling engineers, petroleum engineers, is that we can counter that with putting well casing all the way down to the target zone of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 feet, however deep the structure is going to be located at. So we can counter that by knowing what we have, our problems were from before. The other problem is that we have such a small market, it's hard to incentivize developers, financiers, funders into going out here because our market is so small. If we knew that we had billions of cubic feet available per day, it would be a lot easier. So those are some of the things that we've come across, but we can eliminate most of the problems that were associated with our drilling prospects previously.
Thank you.
Just to give you an idea, because of the high pressure and then putting casing down all the way to the target zone, it's going to be a more expensive well. However, if it's on a road system, we can probably get into the area, the region, throughout the summer, throughout the fall, throughout the winter, versus like on the North Slope or some other areas of Alaska where it's only a winter project only.
Okay, well, keep us advised on progress, and if we can help out, we certainly want to encourage that local gas distribution to improve the economy out there.
Yeah, one of the things is we will be meeting with the House and Senate Resource Committees March 11th, so I'd be happy to share what we have, but from our data processing at that time, we should be completed, and we could probably give you a more specific drill target. And also, what we would like to have you start considering is editing some of these Middle Earth Frontier Tax Basin credits. They are a very good thing. Without the 023 and 025 Middle Earth Tax Credits, we would have never got this far. But we would recommend, you know, editing some of these to make it just a little bit more user-friendly and the payback time be a lot less than what they currently are. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
McGinn, in regards to the Sutton Intertie, Copper Valley Electric provides electrical service to the Greater Copper Basin area and Valdez. We operate the Solomon Gulch Hydro, a combustion turbine cogeneration project adjacent to the PetroStar refinery, and two diesel-fired power plants to meet system requirements. So we're currently constructing the Allison Creek project, which will increase our renewable energy portfolio from 50%, which it is currently, to 64%. The average residential cost per kilowatt hour in the Copper Basin in 2014 was 28 cents a kilowatt hour. CDA does not receive power cost equalization. Other than our 50% of our energy coming from fossil fuel, the other reason for high electric rates is that we operate and maintain four power plants to keep the lights on for our members. We do believe that the best long-term solution for lower and stable electric rates is an intertie to the CDA system with the Rail Belt energy grid. Such a project could take many forms and potentially could have many benefits, including improved reliability and transfer capacity for the entire Rail Belt, create economic development opportunities along the route, enable the development of energy projects currently stranded with no market. A couple of these would be the Teagle River drainage and Silver Lake out in our area. And also the ability to serve new customers, such as the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Services Terminal, and finally to lower electric rates for the Copper Basin and Prince William Sound residents. In recent years, Copper Valley Electric has promoted the idea of looking into an interconnection to the region as part of an ongoing study with the Susitna-Montana project. As you may or may not be aware, we looked at studying an intertie from Glen Allen to Sutton approximately 20 years ago. That was a pre-feasibility study. It gave us a very good baseline and a very good foundation for any work going forward. There would still need to be some work done on that study, but it does get us started. So I'd be happy to take any questions you may have at the conclusion.
Thank you. Next slide, LNG demonstration.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Bruce Kane, Special Projects Manager with Otten Incorporated. And I'm going up to tell you about our LNG demonstration project, which ties into the gas development project that Otten is doing as well. What we're trying to do is kind of get ahead on the local market. We're going to need to hook up a small community natural gas distribution grid, and in order to get started on that, we can already build it today if we truck in LNG and set up a small regasification plant. And what we're proposing is to do that as a demonstration project to share with the rest of the state because we are trying to figure out how to convert small communities or isolated areas to natural gas using this trucked LNG or shipping LNG by barge on the containers. So that's our idea. The benefit to our community is that we would end up with a local gas distribution grid that we can use for our power plant and our business area. It's a fairly small target project. And then that would be available if the gas comes online in the future with the Tolsona area. If the Tolsona area doesn't prove out, we still would have a facility here that would lower our costs, and then we can use as a model to share with the rest of the state on how to convert their communities when the bigger Alaska LNG project is completed. And what we're asking, we have a CAPSIS request in for $175,000 to do the feasibility study on developing this. The total project cost is estimated to be $8 to $10 million, and we would propose to have that funded with some rural development funding from USDA and some other grants and private investments. So that's the LNG demonstration project, and I'll turn it back over to Joe to wrap it up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Payne.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and Energy Committee members. Just in conclusion, you can see the last page there of the slide program that and just to reiterate that we are working together out here. We have many differences and conflicts of things personally and politically and things that go on out here, but energy is one of the things that unites us. And just continuing on with the energy plan and finalizing phase two so that we can have a prioritized list of the top one, two, or three. And from all consensus at the table here, I believe that the Intertie would receive further evaluation, the Alaska LNG demonstration project, and also the Otna natural gas exploration. So those are going to be the three low-hanging fruit that we have out here, and we'd be happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bowie, and thank you, the rest of the presenters. Appreciate this information, and look forward to working with you on progress. Are there any questions from the committee? Hearing none, thank you, gentlemen. We'll take a brief at ease and get ready for the presentation of House Bill 78. Record at 10:48, and we have Representative Wilson to present House Bill 78. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 3, North Pole. Thank you very much for taking time to hear this bill. It is my honor to present HB 78 on behalf of the Alaska Independent Power Producers. Competition is good. Competition brings out the best of America and Alaska. Competition is the basis for a free and market force-driven society. Business and industrial sectors that have vibrant competitive markets work hard to drive down consumer prices. Competition sparks innovation to improve production, shave unnecessary costs, and continually improve customer service in a never-ending pursuit to meet or beat competition. Alaskans understand and embrace competition as an integral component of our existence as Alaskans. Competition is not complicated. Alaskans understand competition as a sports arena and all endeavors that require the pursuit of excellence. As with our world-famous Iditarod dog sled race, we don't just hand out trophies, we expect our Alaskan winners to earn it. Our Alaska electrical energy laws and regulations that not only discourage competition, but more aptly preempt competition and discourage private investment in our electrical energy infrastructure. As a result of our economic counterproduction and anti-competitive policies, Alaska ranks, used to be last, but I hear that Hawaii is now last, so we're 49th, but I wouldn't get too excited, Mr. Chair. It's still pretty bad. And the production of competitive electrical from independent power producers, due in part to a lack of wholesale electrical competition. Also, Alaska has the second highest average residential electricity rates in the nation. Our non-competitive high electric rates negatively impact our economic development and unnecessarily burden our Alaskan businesses, mines, entrepreneurs, and households. Our high electrical energy costs not only impact our economy, they also impact our local government operations, schools, hospitals, and services. A school or hospital dollar unnecessarily spent on uncompetitive electricity is a dollar that could be more productively spent on educating our youth or reducing the health costs for Alaskans. And as you may know, Mr. Chair, our health care is very high at this point. As Alaska started out as a territory and as a young state, we rightfully granted monopoly rights to utilities and awarded exclusive service territories in our effort to provide incentives to drive electrical service to all urban and rural Alaskans alike. However, we have outgrown this monopoly model that now holds back the diversification and vibrancy of our non-oil industry economy. We must integrate wholesale competition to encourage private capital investment into energy generation and transmission to not only decrease electricity costs, but also to improve Alaskans' long-term energy security from future rate increases. Fair play, open access to transmission, non-discrimination in the procurement of lowest cost energy allows market forces to pick winners and provides an avenue for Alaska to meet its goals as stated in our state energy policy. The Alaska Competitive Energy Act embraces competition as a guiding principle for our electrical generation and transmission industry because Alaskans know that competition works. Since I put this bill out, Mr. Chair, I've heard from many private industries on they have actually already built the projects and they are unable to get it onto our grid. As most of you know, we are $3.5 to $4 billion in a hole in the current budget we're in, much less the one that we're working on. We have to engage private businesses. We have to learn to share the grid, not just so we have low cost, but because we want these private partnerships. I also just was handed a letter from one of our, from Chugach Power, Alaska's Future. I want to let you know, Mr. Chair, we took our bill and we sent it out to everyone. We want their comments. We want to understand. So I find it very interesting that it just happened to come on the day that we were here. I'm sure that was coincidental. But in it, I'm very concerned because they want us to wait for a report that may come out. My understanding may not come out until June. Can we really wait? I can look at most of you, and you live in places where the energy costs really determine what you can and cannot do as your own family, how many businesses can stay. And I know in my area, and Ripson Wool can also attest to this, people are moving. They are moving because they keep waiting for more affordable energy, for a better way to be able to just do their daily costs. And we also have at this point, Mr. Chair, businesses that are not moving in to the Fairbanks area because we have not addressed this issue. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have someone could go through a section if you like or do an overview.
Yeah, would you,
however you would prefer.
Representative Wilson, would you walk us through the sectional, please? Briefly, it's
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative. Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Representative Wilson, I just, we have been told here at the Energy Committee that there is a report coming out from the RCA. I know you just got done talking about why wait, but I'm wondering why you're presenting your bill to supersede the RCA's work.
Through the Chair, Representative Tilton, thank you for that question. We had a meeting last year that we had the RCA. It was an energy meeting. And at that meeting, the RCA said that they needed more direction or wanted more direction on how they can better service Alaskans. And that's where this bill came from. They're also making some changes that we may be taking out of the bill as it goes through the RCA process. But to stop it altogether instead of working in tandem, I think slows everything down and makes things more inefficient. But this really was a request by them at the meeting that we had a year ago. Thank you very much. And Mr. Chair, that would be okay. I have Mr. Mitchell here who is part of the Alaska Independent Power Producers. I think your questions will be answered much better. It would be okay if he would give you a high level of the sectional. Would that be okay?
Yeah, we have a few minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. I am Duff Mitchell. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Independent Power Producers Association. We've worked on this bill for going on 3 years. I can provide you an in-depth sectional, or I can provide an overview.
Provide us an overview, please.
Okay. The overview is that this bill basically embodies competition and fair play. It puts in non-discrimination elements. It opens up doors for access to transmission. It sets real basic ground rules. It doesn't pick winners and losers. It just says everybody can play and play on the same rules. Currently, Alaska is out of sync with the rest of the country in its regulation of generation and transmission. And what this bill does is bring us not ahead of the country, but just brings us up to the same stage as the rest of the country. One of the reasons why we believe our statistics are so poor with competitive generation and high cost is because we're not invigorating the competitive forces. We're not invigorating the market forces. Now, some people have said that maybe this is deregulation. It is not. It is wholesale competitive regulation. Any contract that an IPP would need to go and be sold on a power purchase agreement to a utility, and then it would have to be authorized or okayed by the RCA. Secondly, we had Alaska State Energy Policy. It was passed and initiated by this body, the House Special Committee on Energy, in 2010. What we had was it went through the process and everybody said, hey, we're going to do 50% renewable. We're going to promote 50% renewable by 2025. We're going to promote the development of renewable energy. We're also going to encourage coal and other gas hydrates for electrical development in our state. And we were going to encourage economic development by creating and maintaining a state fiscal regime that streamlined our regulatory processes. Today, the RCA takes 2 years for a docket. In a private business, that's a lifetime. Puts you out of business. If you got a bunch of attorneys that can put you into a hold, that's one thing where it streamlines in the bill. We all believed in the state energy policy, but in an RCA docket that was held in 2012, some smart utility attorneys presented to the RCA that, look, you don't have to go with the state energy policy. It's aspirational. If the legislature wanted this issue to be resolved, they know how to do it, and they would have put it in 4205. So this bill is a reflection of that wise advice from the utility attorneys.
Could you explain to the committee, this is directing the RCA to do a lot of revisions and rulemaking. What's the thrust of the legislation as far as deep in the weeds on RCA evaluation and oversight? Give us that broad overview of what is it telling the RCA to do different than it's doing now.
It's right now the RCA has some rules that were promulgated since 1982. They're a little bit out of sync with PURPA. It talks about avoided costs, which the R docket R13002 narrowly addresses, but it doesn't do anything about open access to transmission and charging the same equal costs like you get in the rest of the country. So it brings in a lot of the non-discriminatory equal playing field aspects. It also embodies that right now when an RCA commissioner looks at a docket, he does not need to, or she does not need to, take into consideration our state energy policy, because our state energy policy is vague and aspirational. What this bill does is transforms that piece of legislation that was passed by this body into and codify our values of that state energy policy. So now the RCA would be required to have to put into their decision-making process the aspects of the state energy policy. And in that state energy policy, it's attempting to streamline things and to make things more equal and fair. If I've answered your question, Mr. Chair.
What are the reporting requirements going to be of utilities, and how will that affect their rate structure?
It asks utilities to produce and publish avoided costs for their generation. And why that's important is that if you know what the scoreboard is, you know how to compete against it. Right now, you think you have a hydropower in Cantwell, or you think you have a hydropower somewhere, or a wind project, and you're doing the pre-feasibility stage, you're going, geez, maybe it's going to be 10 cents, maybe it's going to be 15 cents. So it asks the utilities to publish their avoided costs so that you have a scoreboard in which to compete with.
Are they not public now and confidential? What's the...
Some utilities publish a small, like if it's under 100 kW, but they do not publish out their avoided costs for each source of generation. They publish an average, so it's a conglomerated, which the law says you can displace your incremental cost. So if you have 2 cent hydropower that might have built 100 years ago, and you have 30 cent diesel, that averages 15. But in reality, you're competing against that incremental cost, and so it needs to be known if you're an IPP.
Okay. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Avoided costs, obviously, is a big issue here, and I haven't read all the amendments to, but maybe you can help me explain, help explain to me. Obviously, avoided means that's a cost they don't want to have to pay. So, and I don't know, is there an averaging process? I know that that's a big issue as far as IPPs selling to utilities or or that issue? In other words, how does the avoided costs enter the equation?
Sure, that's a great question. In 1982, when every state, PURPA passed in 1978, and each state had to implement its version of PURPA. In 1982, a docket was opened up, and the RCA at the time, which was called APOC, said that although incremental cost analysis would have been the appropriate, it's more preferable, they said. Our utilities have written in and stated that this is too sophisticated for them, that they're not sophisticated enough to calculate out the incremental costs, and they said that this would be temporary. So the difference is that in PURPA, you're supposed to displace that higher cost oil and the higher cost costs, because if you can beat that higher cost costs, you actually bring down the cost of the consumers. But when you average it, you're competing against maybe a project that was built in 1960. You can't do that with today's dollars. You can't hire union people at $1960 dollars. So this is where there's a difference, and the avoided cost is important, but the federal definition and what the RCA is leaning toward, which they haven't ruled on, is that we will go to an incremental cost system instead of an average avoided cost system. So it's allowing you to displace that higher cost fuel with a competitive source.
Okay.
Any other questions, committee? Seems like we need a utility lawyer in our back pocket to decipher all this, RCA. We want to show for the record that Representative Magiak joined us at 11:02. Welcome, Benny.
Mr. Mitchell, how much... If there was a Transco or a independent system operator that was dispatching energy and we had a robust transmission system, how many of these issues would go away as far as being able for an IPP to introduce power into a system and have it dispatched independently to users throughout the grid?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the devil's in the details. This bill lays the ground rules. If you have non-discrimination, you have fair play, everybody's treated equally, and when I say equally, everybody pays the same cost. Nobody's grandfathered in some special rates or some unique circumstances where somebody has a huge competitive advantage over somebody else. But I'm not so sure that just trading an ISO or Transco will solve anything unless you have the ground rules and the foundation in which to build that on. Right now, if you take six utilities in the rail belt and you put them into an organization to create their own rules, which independent of the ACA is what would occur, we don't know what those rules would be. And so there's a great risk by not having legislative direction and legislative guidance of principles on any creation of that.
Thank you.
Representative Bashquist?
So can you summarize for the record what those ground rules are in this bill?
Yeah, the summary is simple in the fact that everybody has an equal stake, everybody pays the same rate, everybody is treated equally, everybody has the same rules of integration and interconnection, so your on-ramp and your off-ramps are equal, and that you have a voice in any future decision-making where that body will go. I've looked at the RTEC bylaws, and the current published bylaw says that you will have utility that are currently certificated, and co-op utilities and municipal utilities are on their board of directors. Okay, so when you go into executive session, where is that IPP or where is the other things? So this bill says that regardless of how you set up that organization, you're going to play by those simple rules. And that allows you stability in which to get financing, because right now it's very difficult to get private financing based on rules that are a black box, or could be a black box, I should say.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. We'll open up our public hearing. We've got two people online, and then we'll open it up in the room. But we won't close the public hearing today, and we'll leave it open because we don't have a lot of time to continue on this bill today. Suzanne Gibson, are you online? How about Joel Groves?
Oh, I'm here.
Okay, Suzanne, if you would please state your name for the record and if you'd like to testify on House Bill 78.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Gibson. I'm the Senior Director of Energy Development for Cook Inlet Region. And before you today to express serious support for House Bill 78, Siri appreciates Representative Tammy Wilson and this committee for considering new legislation that will facilitate reaching the state's legislative policy goal and encouraging renewable and alternative generation sources that can contribute to the diversity and reliability of the electric grid. In my role at Siri, I have primary responsibility for the development of energy projects. This includes the Fire Island Wind Project. Siri has been delivering clean, renewable wind power to Chugach Electric since the first phase of the project was completed in September of 2012. Since that time, Fire Island Wind has generated more than 120,000 megawatt hours and lowered Chugach's gas consumption by almost 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas. Siri has experienced firsthand the difficult and often winding roads to project development faced by IPPs. We also understand the importance of cooperative interaction with the purchasing utilities. Without the proactive cooperation of Chugach in negotiating the power purchase agreement for Fire Island, the project would have fallen by the wayside. In 2014, Siri worked to develop the second phase of Fire Island. However, even though power from Phase 2 was offered at 6.3 cents per kilowatt hour, no utility was willing to execute a bilateral power purchase agreement. Without a voluntary buyer, and given the extremely competitive price, Siri seriously considered proceeding under the existing QF regulations. However, we quickly determined that the regulatory framework would not enable the project to move forward on a successful timeline, and that the rules were non-existent or too loose to rely on for making a prudent investment decision. The legislature is aware of the RPA's proposal to revise regulations regarding cogeneration and small power production in docket R13-2. The proposed rules are intended to better mirror FERC's regulations for qualifying facilities, which was passed in 1978, but has never been fully implemented in Alaska. The proposed regulations are not yet codified and may be met with more resistance from utilities and additional attempts to water down the language during the upcoming comment period. However, even if the proposed regulations are approved in whole, additional action is needed from the legislature. R13-2 does not provide the framework for creating competitive wholesale electricity, and it does not ensure non-discriminatory access to the transmission system for qualifying facilities and independent power producers. This can be accomplished with House Bill 78. Importantly, a clear legislative framework has been requested not only by IPPs, but also by commissioners of the Regulatory Commission. Neither utilities, IPPs, or regulators are comfortable operating, investing, or regulating in legislatively gray areas. The lack of legislative rules regarding fair consideration and non-discriminatory open access transmission service are the primary barriers preventing successful development of Fire Island Wind Phase 2. And therefore, here as a party who has direct and recent experience to testify in support of House Bill 78, Alaska's Competitive Energy Act. I offer this testimony not as an opponent to robot utilities, but rather as an advocate of appropriate and necessary changes. Alaska needs to adopt the practices long ago implemented by the energy utility industry across the United States by removing the impediments to competition in the wholesale power market. In 2015, Siri planned to invest $50 million to add more than 20 megawatts of nuclear capacity to the wind project. Expansion of the project would diversify the region's fuel supply, provide much-needed economic stimulus, cut carbon emissions and move Alaska towards its state renewable energy goals. Three rail belt utilities considered buying energy from Phase 2. But lacking a definitive set of rules or a legislative mandate to guide decision-making, each utility exercised its own unique discretion. This includes discretion to apply overly conservative assumptions relating to the cost of integrating and transmitting the power from Fire Island. I could recite numerous specific examples on how the lack of rules and unfettered discretion have constructed barriers to IPP development and Fire Island Wind specifically. In the interest of time, I will share only a few. First, Shugash's existing transmission tariff discriminates against independent power producers. Shugash is a founding member of ARCTEC. ARCTEC cites that providing non-discriminatory transmission access and service is a guiding principle for the unified system operator. Even so, Shugash's own RCA-approved transmission tariff defines an eligible customer as a utility that holds a certificate of public convenience and necessity from the commission. In other words, no IPP can qualify to be an eligible customer with access to move power across the transmission system. Therefore, the only alternative for an IPP is to negotiate a special transmission service contract and wait for regulatory approval, a process which Shugash estimated could take up to 18 months, much too slow for private investment. Second, the rules for determining integration costs for IPP power are inadequate, leaving the utilities full of discretion to apply their own assumptions. In the case of Phase 2, ultra-conservative assumptions were applied, including a penalty for less efficient use of existing generators, the capital cost of a brand new gas-fired generator to be used exclusively for integrating wind, the assumed loss of value from hydro resources, the addition of utility personnel, punitive natural gas price increases due solely to the utility's decision to purchase wind, uncertain transmission wheeling rates across the utility system, and the list goes on from there.
Can you please summarize, please?
The lack of rules governing fair interactions between IPPs and utilities is difficult for both the utility and the IPP. For instance, we routinely negotiate with the same three or four individuals for the interconnection agreement, the power sales agreement, and the transmission wheeling agreement. Putting utility employees in this position is unfair and clearly does not create a level playing field which maximizes cooperation and competition between the utility and IPP projects. I have more prepared comments, but I think I'll just stop there and see if there are any questions.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Ms. Gibson. You'll have opportunity to submit more comments. The bill's not moving today. Joel Groves, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Okay, please proceed and make it. Under 3 minutes, please. We've got to keep moving.
Understood. I'd like to first just briefly thank Representative Wilson for introducing House Bill 78 and also the committee for hearing it today. My comments are fairly brief. I represent Fish Hook Renewable Energy. We're developing a run-of-river hydro project up in the Matsu Valley in Hatcher Pass. And our experience basically affirms those articulated by Mr. Mitchell this morning and also Ms. Gibson, that the existing regulatory framework is pretty much hostile to IPP development in Alaska, which is the principal reason why we've seen so little of it to date. We've been developing or pursuing Fish Hook since approximately 2006, 9 years now, and there's been a number of delays stemming solely from the existing regulatory framework that have delayed that project. The rail belt utilities that we've been dealing with, Matanuska Electric Association and Chugach Electric Association, the current management teams there and boards have actually been fairly conducive to IPPs, generally, or at least in our experience, generally speaking, in the sense that Series been able to develop a project. There have been a few other small IPPs that have been happening in the Rail Belt or in South Central in the past few years. But, you know, that said, it's still not a level playing field, which is why HB 78 has been developed. And the, let's see here, I guess the extent that those utilities have been supportive of IPPs is not because of the regulatory framework that exists today, but because of the management cultures at those utilities. That could change at any time, and we'd have a far more hostile environment than we have today. So that's sort of the principal reasons why HB 78 is so important. And while there is an RCA docket that covers some of the scope of the revisions or reforms articulated in HB 78, the docket has a far more limited scope. It's also a very uncertain outcome. So HB 78, I think, is really critical to moving Alaska's energy sector or electrical sector towards a more competitive framework and ultimately lower energy costs. Those are my comments. I'll certainly entertain any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Okay. We'll move to testimony in the room. Signed up, we have Tim McLeod with Alaska Electric Light and Power. Name for the record, thank you.
Okay, then, thank you for letting me do this. My name,
3 minutes or less, we're going to have this back up.
I will, okay. My name is Tim McLeod. I'm president of Alaska Electric Light and Power, serving utility serving Juneau. We've served Juneau for over 120 years now. We are now a subsidiary of Avista Corporation out of Spokane, Washington. I want to clarify a few things. I believe that this bill will actually raise the cost of energy in Alaska, not reduce the cost of energy in Alaska. And I want to clarify one other thing, and that is that there's a testimony that that most of the generating units in Alaska are not paid for with private funds. But I can assure you that all of ours in the Serve Juneau are paid for with private funds. We're an investor-owned utility. We own the Gold Creek, Annex Creek, Salmon Creek, and Lake Dorothy hydro projects. And the Snowsham Electric project that was built by the federal government, we have full financial responsibility for that. So that is being paid for through our rates by private investment. And I believe that that's the case throughout the state, that most of the projects are being paid for through rates, through private investment. I wanted to first clarify what my company's corporate goals are, and those are to provide reliable and safe electrical service from renewable resources, to provide among the lowest average rates of the major regulated utilities within Alaska over the long run while maintaining financial integrity, and use electrical resources efficiently. That is our total corporate goals. We are interested in the well-being of this community. We know that our company depends on the well-being of this community to thrive over the long run. We certainly have the capability of becoming an IPP. We could transfer our units to ownership of an IPP, but I believe it raises rates in general to do that. I believe that most of the utilities in the state have very similar goals: provide low-cost, reliable, safe electricity. And that's why I believe most of the utilities in the state are opposed to this legislative change proposal. The utilities are always susceptible to disruption of their planning to provide low-cost energy by existing regulations. For example, a utility is required to buy power now from a qualified facility, which is an IPP with renewable energy that's certified as a qualified facility. And in our case, we would then, if a qualified facility showed up at my door today and said, "I have energy for you to purchase," I would then have to shut off some of my hydro projects and purchase theirs. And the way I understand that, it would be not at my avoided cost, but at the the incremental cost, and as Mr. Mitchell described that, that might be the cost of diesel power generation. I want to give one other example of how an IPP could raise the cost. Inside Passage Electric recently built or is in the process of constructing a small hydro project in Hoonah. I was willing and able as an IPP to construct that project for them if they were unable to. They were able to get some grant funds to build that project, which significantly will provide significantly lower rates than I would have been able to provide if I had built that project with private funds. I would have had to recover my costs with a debt, with a return on equity and so forth. And so by Hoonah being able to do that and use some grant funds, they significantly lowered the cost of energy in Hoonah. So I would just urge the legislature to leave this matter to the RCA to determine what their findings are, review their findings. I believe they have the expertise to make sound decisions on this and write policy that the utilities will be bound to. And so with that, I'll conclude my comments.
Thank you. next, we have Mike Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Kraft. I live at 1160 Pickering Drive, Fairbanks, Alaska. And I've been listening to some of the comments here, and I'll try to keep it short. Planning. I heard that just now. Planning. I got into this market in 2007 because I didn't see any planning. I saw my community going into a tailspin and got involved to try and do something about that. And here we are 7 years later, and we're still in tailspin. So I'm curious of where all of this planning has led us on behalf of the utilities. Raise the rates. You know, I looked at the letters of support and the letters against this bill today, and I saw the same kind of letters that I saw with my R docket. You had utilities come forward and say, you know, we don't like it. No reasons, no justification. We just don't like it. You're going to raise our rates. Well, I've never seen a document to say how we're going to raise their rates. Because that's not true. We're not going to raise the rates. The avoided cost you talked about, Representative Will, through the chair, the average avoided cost is what I get paid for my electricity right now. And what happens is, the more I sell to them, the lower my price goes, because I become part of the average. So if I'm not competing against their highest cost avoided, like, for example, diesel at 37 cents a kilowatt hour, and I'm having to compete with Aurora Power Plant at 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour, and I end up with an average of 9.8 cents, every time they make a payment to me, it actually brings down the cost, the payment they would make to me the next time. And it gives me no leverage to try and compete with the higher cost fuels, the diesel that we're burning in Fairbanks. And so the average avoided cost calculations that are being used right now on a federal level are illegal. Not to mention, they just absolutely camouflage the true cost of what it cost us to produce power across the state, utility by utility. Those costs are hidden from the public. The RCA asked for regulations. They asked for more direction from the legislature. And the reason they did that is because they are not they're regulators. They're not legislators. They can't act on stuff that hasn't been passed through the state legislature, this body, and they've asked for these regulations. And as far as timing goes, I know that you guys are a little concerned about this, obviously, that this is moving fast, but I can tell you that from where I sit, it's been 7 years coming. And Fairbanks, the people that I'm concerned about, my neighbors, and the people that are leaving our town, we're out of time. We're flat out of time. And for this to sit another year, you might as well take a machine gun up there and just start shooting people, because it's a dead zone up there. And the reason it's a dead zone is because there hasn't been any planning by the utilities. They should have been on to Sedna in 95. They should have been talking about a gas project, something as a collective effort by the utilities. There was no planning. I heard Joe Griffin talk about he didn't even know where he was going to get his gas from the next year. This was 2 years ago. From Two Guys Electric. That's not planning. We're tired of it. We want to see planning. We want to see a firm economy. based on good, solid energy. And the IPPs bring that to the table. We have projects that will bring the cost of power down, create jobs right now. These projects are ready to go.
Okay. We got time for one more. Jody Mitchell, are you here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jody Mitchell, I am the CEO and General Manager of Inside Passage Electric Cooperative. I just have a couple comments that I'll try to be very brief. I urge this body to wait on the RCA R1302 decision. The RCA is the appropriate body to be determining these questions that have been raised. All of us in the utility world have to deal with the RCA on a regular basis. I understand there's a frustration over how long things take, but that's just part of life of being a utility. I heard comments about us, we're number 49 out of 50 in terms of our efficiencies and our cost of power and whatnot. Well, part of that problem is because we're such a huge state, we're not all interconnected. We don't have these superhighways of transmission assets that make this such an easy situation. And I think hopefully at some point we'll all be interconnected and things will be different, but it's not the case now, certainly not. I think that, putting it, part of the, I read this morning, this puts a lot of the study and integration cost burden on the utilities and therefore on its consumers. This could be a very significant cost, especially if it's frivolous. I personally spend a lot of time getting the shiny shoes in town syndrome that comes to me on a regular basis. In fact, I'm dealing with two of those right now that want to sell me power and say that they're going to do it for 16 cents and they're going to displace all my diesel. I mean, this is, it's a daily thing that I go through. And a lot of these things are just, they're not actually working projects. They don't have, they can't show me a project that's actually working right now. I mean, it's crazy. But I would say that if an IPP came to me and could truly provide me a lower cost power that to displace my diesel, I would absolutely want to purchase it. Because that would reduce my rates to my consumers, and that's what all of us are trying to do here as utilities. One more thing. IPEC's rate of return is only about 4% or less, and we're a cooperative, we're a nonprofit. An IPP, I would believe, would not be happy with a 4% rate of return. So where does the cost savings come? I would turn it back on Mr. Kraft here and ask him to show me the economics that prove that he is going to lower costs, because I don't see it. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we're going to hold the public hearing open on House Bill 78 and set that bill aside. And we're going to move Mr. Klayman.
Just a question. I'll respond to that. Is the RCA giving an any opinion on this proposal, and when might we hear from them? I know there's a report coming out in June, but are we going to get any input from them before then?
I don't have anything new on that. And, co-chair?
Our communications with the RCA indicates that we'll be discussing this issue tomorrow, so we may be able to have some more information regarding. The report in June is very restricted, and at the next meeting I will read into the record the mission of that report is to consider whether independent service operator is the most efficient way to deal with the well belt congestion. It's very narrow, so that report itself may not necessarily take care of everything that is in HB 78, but the RCA should provide more information after tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything else on House Bill 78? With that, we'll move into House Bill 105. Madam Co-Chair?
Yes. For the record, I wanted to disclose that my husband, Mark Davis, is an employee of ADA. There is no conflict. It was determined after discussing with legislative efforts, but I thought it's the right thing to do to disclose that.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. That bit of housekeeping. With that, we have House Bill 105 before the committee. We have a CS, and would ask the Representative Tilton would move the CS before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Kutcher. I move that we adopt the CS 29GH1019-W.
Without objection, that is before the committee. Just a brief recap to the committee on what the CS, the changes to the CS. Page 4, section 4, line 21, reauthorizes the $50 million authority to ADA for a port facility at Port McKenzie. This is an old language. It had been changed several times in several different projects, and this CS would then reauthorize that authority. According to ADA, they like to have fresh authorization within 5 years of a legislative action, and if anything older than that, they would seek the legislature's approval. For the record, we do have Michael Lamb, CFO of ADA Online, and Gene Terrio for questions with the AEA. The other issue on the CS, the language on page 5, lines 1 through 3, changed the language because this was previously authorization for a project originating on the North Slope, simply changes the intent to deliver energy to the interior. So, with that, not seeing anything else, that's it, right? Okay. Acting Commissioner Parody, did you have any comments on anything? Or are you just available for questions?
Available for questions.
Okay. So, let the record show that. Are you still our acting commissioner?
Yes,
okay,
sir.
The acting commissioner Parody is with us for questions. We do have one amendment, and I would ask Representative Tilton to move that amendment. To clarify, the section 4 we discussed with the reauthorization of the funding for Port McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move amendment number 1.
Okay, you want to state that for the record? Would it, we're striking a couple words.
Sure. Amendment number 1 would strike on page 4, line 20, would delete loading and conveyor.
Loading and conveyor. So the amendment before the committee is the first 3 words on line 20, loading and conveyor. Just delete those words.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that amendment is before the committee. Is there objection? Hearing none, that amendment number 1 carries. Are there any other amendments to this legislation?
I have a question.
Question.
I'm just reading the amendment, and it looks like there may be one more word that should be deleted because it just reads, issue bonds to finance the acquisition, design, and construction of a port facility and related equipment related. Looks like we've got one too many relateds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would suggest that we should delete the first related.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't want nepotism involved in
that. And equipment. Okay.
Yep.
So,
agreed.
Would amendment number 2, would you make that?
I can make a motion that we delete the first related.
Okay,
the amendment.
Amendment number 2 is to strike related on page 4, line 19, the last word. Is there objection? Is there a discussion? Is there hearing none, amendment carries. Amendment number 2 carries. Anything else? Okay. How about debate or questions of the AEA or ADA? Go ahead, Representative Klayman.
Just for logic, some as I understand it, ADA likes to have kind of fresh authorization about what its directions are for investing in different projects, and so this basically gives a direction that's consistent with where the governor wants to go on different ADA projects.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Klayman, yes, and specifically the bills needed to open us from considering solely North Slope sourced gas in the Interior Energy Project to a broader authorization.
Okay. Thank you. There are a number, and just to relate it to the language at Point McKenzie, there are a number of different private sector proposals out there for LNG facilities, and the intent of the rail spur to the port at Point McKenzie is to move product more competitively. And so that authorization has been requested by the Matsu Borough. This is something that a number of us have been involved in for quite a few years, and it's not a port to compete with Anchorage. Anchorage is primarily cargo terminal, container shipping, so that this authority would then be in place if we have a project or expansion of the dock out there in concert with the private sector venture, LNG or otherwise, that we could help build our economy. So with that, any other further comments?
Yeah, I'd like to put on the record that a lot of this bill simply increases the authority of ADA to issue bonds in certain amounts. That, for instance, in Section 1, it increases from $6 million to $10 million. In Section 2, from $10 million to $25 million. Section 3, from $20 million to $25 million. Two areas. And further along, yeah, those are increases in ADA's authority to issue bonds.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, for that clarification. Is there any discussion on the bill? Any comments? I would just like to say that the folks that I represent in Delta Junction are looking for leadership on cheaper energy, or we'll call it affordable energy, to the interior. And anything and everything we can do to move that along, I think, is in the interest of Alaska. And I do sincerely want to help the interior build a stronger economy. That will help keep the military located there and encourage them to expand. I think it's imperative that we quit talking about getting gas to Alaskans, not just the interior, but coastal and rural Alaska, and we start doing something. And I'm hopeful that, you know, I realize this bill has a long ways to go, but I'm hopeful that we will at some point have convergence, and that we'll all be working towards the same goal of affordable energy for Alaskans. So is there objection further? Adam, got anything to say? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I second what you said, and that I think it's important to show that we are doing something and not just talking. And I think the people in the interior specifically and elsewhere would be happy to see that there's motion and movement on this. So,
any further comments? Is there objection to moving the bill out of committee? Hearing and seeing none, House Bill 105 is moved out of committee with individual recommendations and no fiscal note. And if we could take a brief at ease to sign the bill documents, and we'll go back on record and adjourn out. Clarify our parliamentary procedure here, so we're going to move the bill out of committee, going to Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CSHB 105/W as amended with attached zero fiscal note.
Okay, and with individual recommendations. Is there an objection to moving the bill out of committee? Hearing none, the bill is moved out of committee, and now we'll sign our bill statements. Thank you. Time to wrap up here. We have no further business before the committee. The co-chair and I were talking about perhaps need some expert legal advice on that previous measure we took up HB 78. Is it the will of the committee that we maybe have a utility lawyer explain this to us in depth?
Okay.
So if the committee aides would work with us on getting the proper advisor, and next time we bring that up, I think it would be helpful if they appear before the committee. I'm kind of in the dark here with this RCA legalese. And I think it's important that we look at this bill. I think both of the chairs feel that way, that we do need to look at it. And obviously, there's lots of different points of view, so before that bill would be ready to move, we would have to have quite a bit of testimony and work on that bill. So with that, we're scheduled for Thursday. If there's nothing on the docket, we just have bills previously heard. You'll hear by tomorrow afternoon whether or not we are going to counsel on Thursday, but otherwise we're planning on Thursday morning.
Will you know by the site floor session tomorrow?
I said that, what, tomorrow afternoon?
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll have one of your amendments and be there till afternoon.
I haven't known that.
All right, thank you. With that, we'll adjourn.